Good evening, everyone. In America today, we celebrate Thanksgiving, so I will say happy Thanksgiving, even though it doesn't really mean anything to you apart from Debbie. And it's a day that has deep historic roots, but it's become mostly a holiday where people gather, families gather, and have a great feast together. And a lot of time and effort is put into preparing the food, which is unusual for Americans. People travel. It's the busiest travel day in the year. They go far to be with their families, and they eat a big meal, and then the men sit around and watch football, and the women clean up. No, that's a stereotype, but there's also a lot of football matches during the holiday, during today and tomorrow. But the point of Thanksgiving is to, as it says, give thanks. And it has kind of a twisted backstory because its origin was that the original people who came from England, the first in, the 16th, probably early 17th century, probably, or maybe sooner, I'm not sure. Had a very difficult time because it was wilderness and they didn't know anything about how to survive there. They were religious people who were persecuted. They weren't necessarily really farmers or capable of creating a settlement that they could survive in. And the local people, the indigenous peoples, helped them through the first winter and helped them in the spring then to plant food, showed them, what the local things they could grow and how to do it and help them get through and plant. And then in the fall, when they had a harvest, the newcomers, the English settlers, invited the locals who had helped them to share a meal, to share a feast around all this food that they'd been able to produce for themselves. And it was a gesture of thanks. They were giving thanks to these people for having helped them. And as we sometimes say, maybe the indigenous people regretted having helped them because we know what happened to the indigenous people eventually. They lost their homes and their land and their way of life to these people who they had helped to survive. But so that spirit of giving thanks remains. And some of the traditional food is what they said was from the original meal, from the original feast, wild turkey, although now the turkeys aren't wild, squash, potatoes. Whatever else there, what are the other vegetables happen to be available to them, and those things are still eaten on American Thanksgiving tables to this day. So it's a day that Americans anywhere remember. It's always the last Thursday in November. Even if we don't celebrate it, everyone thinks about it. Everyone I know anyway who is American, or even Lisa, who just arrived and who didn't even grow up in America and hardly lived in America, only briefly, and her mother celebrated it every year, and so she knows about Thanksgiving. Or Joa is another one whose mother is American and she celebrated it every year. I was a bad American mother in France. I didn't celebrate it with my children. Although they're aware of it and occasionally would celebrate it, but we didn't do it every year. So, I just make note of that. And as I was, thinking about tonight and the talk, and our practice is so much about gratitude and recognition and letting go of attachments and opening to the unknown that it doesn't seem so surprising of it for us in terms of our practice that we would give thanks in our formal way of eating in Orioki. There's a lot of, giving thanks. 72 labors brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us and offering it to the spirits to satisfy them. It's a familiar notion. Although, we can lose touch with it and we can forget. Sometimes we become attached to our ideas about what we have, what we want, what we shouldn't have, how life should be. And then we lose contact with that gratitude and thankfulness for things as they are. I saw a quote recently from from Noam Chomsky, who is, this social scientist, thinker, philosopher. And he said, "The world is very mysterious and confusing. It's a very mysterious and confusing place. If you're not willing to get confused, you become a replica of someone else's mind." Which is quite interesting, that if we just, attach to the way someone tells us things are, then we're just a replica of that person's point of view, of that person's position. Or it can be even ourselves, right? We're just a replica of our own point, this fixed idea we have about things. We're not true, we're not real. So when he says become confused, I think of that as opening to not knowing. And when we open to not knowing things as we think they are, it can be confusing. But actually, if we just open to it, there's no confusion. The confusion comes when things aren't like we think they should be. But when we don't know how they should be, when we've let go, then there's no more confusion. If we're looking for a reference point, then it's very confusing because where am I? Who is this? Someone I was recently talking to some English people, and the subject of Thanksgiving came up, and they asked me what the story was. And so, I told the story that I told you, and I said the original pilgrims, because that's what we call them, they were pilgrims fleeing religious persecution, and they came from England and they came to America. And so these English people said, one of them said, "Oh, yeah, that must have been really destabilizing for the English that first winter." And I kind of stopped and I thought, what's he talking about? Because in the American mindset, those people aren't English, they're American. We, the pilgrims, are American. Those first settlers, they're American. We know, of course, we know they came from England, but they're American. And so when they said, and they, these English people, they just, they, for them, they were English. And that was this moment of like confusion in my head. For like a split second, I thought, what? Of course. They're English. They were English, and the guy said, "Yeah, they even came from this town not far from where I live in Lincolnshire, and the town is known for that. That's they were the people in that town were persecuted for their religious beliefs, and they fled to America. They were the first ones to go." So for them, it's all about the English, and for us, these Americans, it's all about the Americans. And I don't think anyone even for a moment thinks that how those people sounded when they talked. But of course, they'd had English accents. What we think of today as an English accent, probably it was much different than what it is now. The French don't like to hear, but apparently the French as it was spoken in like the, 15th, 16th century, actually was quite similar to the way that it's spoken in Quebec today. It has changed very little from the French has not evolved as much in Quebec as it has evolved in Europe. And the French don't like to hear that because they think the Quebecers speak this weird French, this terrible accent. You can't understand them and they make fun of them. But actually, it's true. And they say that there's some accents in America that are probably closer to what English sounded at that time when it was settled. So you see, we have to let go of all of these ideas we have and enter this unknowing, this confusion of, I don't know. I don't know what English sounds like. I don't know what those people, they, I'm sure, were calling themselves English when they came. Now, how long did they call themselves English? I don't know. And then they called themselves settlers, and then they called themselves pilgrims. The next generation that was born, I guess, became Americans, although it wasn't America yet. So they were still colonists. That was also something that they're called as colonists. So what we call a thing is not necessarily what it is, obviously. We have to let go of those identities that we take on and that we use. And so when I was thinking about the banquet, the huge food and the feast and Thanksgiving and everything, I was reminded of the great Sufi Islam kind of folklore figure, Nasreddin, who there's so many stories about Nasreddin, who was this, actually was Turkish. I mean, was born in a part of Turkey. I'm not sure which century, but his great folklore throughout the Islamic world and especially in Sufism. And the stories have been picked up by other spiritual traditions too. And he's kind of this crazy wise guy, crazy. How would we call that in French? Sage fou? No, I forget. Anyway, he's very wise, but people think that he's crazy and dumb, right? So, and he plays on that. And there's lots of stories of him being invited to a banquet of the great caliph or the prince, and different incidents with it. And so I was thinking about those things with him. And so one of them is that a friend of his comes to visit him and says that he got an invitation to the prince's banquet, the great feast that the prince was throwing, and that he couldn't believe he got an invitation, but he had done all these services for the prince, and I don't know what exactly. And he said to Nasreddin, actually, the truth is I licked his boots, but I got an invitation to the feast, and isn't that amazing? And you could too, actually. It's not that difficult to do. And Nasreddin says, well, what would I have to do? And he said, well, basically you would have to lick his boots. And Nasreddin, who was at the time having his meal, eating a lentil soup, said, oh, yeah, that's interesting. But his friend said, yes, and apparently the desserts are just absolutely fabulous. And so Nasreddin said, well, I suppose I could, but I think the taste of licking the prince's boots would make it so that I wouldn't be able to enjoy the desserts. And went back to eating his simple lentil soup. So can we see in a story like this, can we appreciate just what we have and not like project what this amazing thing we could have? Because often this amazing thing that we want to have would involve doing a lot of things that we wouldn't really want to do, like licking the prince's boots. And of course, literally, he wouldn't have been licking the prince's boots, but that's an expression that we use to say you'd have to really do things that aren't very pleasant, and that therefore it might not taste so good what you eventually get. And what you actually have is wonderful. And Nasreddin could really appreciate his lentil soup. One of the other stories of him going to the banquet was this time he was supposed to be the guest of honor at the banquet because he had this reputation of being wise, although most people made fun of him. And nobody really, everybody had heard of him, but nobody really knew who he was. They'd heard these stories about him. So he said, okay, I'll go to the banquet. And he shows up, and the guard at the gate said, you can't come in. This is the feast for the prince and the caliph or whoever it was. It's private. You can't come in. And Nasreddin said, well, I'm the guest of honor. And the guard said, oh yeah, right. You're the guest of honor, like I'm the caliph, Go away and don't come back. Something like that. So Nasreddin leaves, and he's in his old clothes and everything. And as he's going away, he goes by one of his friend's houses, and his friend has he knocks on his friend's door, and he remembers that his friend had tried to give him this beautiful garment with jewels and fine sewing and thread and everything, and brocade, and he didn't want it, Nasreddin. So he goes to his friend and he said, "Do you still have that robe that you were going to give me?" And the friend said, "Yes, I do. I wanted to give it to you, remember?" And he said, "Yeah, I know, you did. And if you still are willing to give it to me, can I have it?" His friend said, "By all means, take it. Yes, you can." And Nazarene said, "And I can do anything I want with it, right? And yes, it's yours. You can have it." So he puts on the fancy robe, goes back to the meal and the banquet, and the guards immediately let him in, and he's set at the place of honor, and they're served, and there's this fabulous soup that is served, and everyone is waiting for Nasreddin to eat before they begin, right? So he stands up with his bowl of soup, and he said, "This looks like a delicious meal. Thank you. I'm grateful for this." And then dumps it on his robe, dumps the whole bowl of soup on his robe. And everyone said, "You fool, what are you doing? How could you do that? The beautiful robe and this amazing soup." And he said, "Well, I'm hoping that the robe enjoys it because it's the robe who was wanted at this meal, not me." Did anyone understand in the attendance? I don't know. Can we appreciate people for who they are? Can we not expect a certain way of looking, a certain way of being? Can we not attach to beautiful, fine clothing as making someone worthy. Even what the guest of honor should do with his soup. Okay, he dumps it on his robe. Fine. Of course, everyone was offended, and maybe some people understood. And Nasruddin was grateful to his friend, certainly, for having given him that robe and grateful for having let him do what he wanted with it. And then the next time he was invited, he didn't go, Nasruddin, to the prince's dinner. He managed to, this time, in one of the other stories, I know these Nasruddin stories because I love them so much, but he, another time when he was supposed to be the guest or one of the guests of honor, the prince sent a wonderful carriage to come and pick him up. And so the carriage man arrived, and Nasruddin was not planning to go to the meal, to the dinner. And the coachman said, I'm here to pick up the great Nasruddin. And so Nasruddin says, just a minute, I'll get him for you, and goes back in the house, comes back out, and he said, he's coming, but he does not want to be seen by you. He's very humble and shy, and he does not want you to rest your eyes on him. And the coachman said, oh, absolutely, okay. And he covered his eyes and put his cloak over his head. And Nasruddin opened the door to the house, shut it, opened the door to the carriage, shut it, said, okay, Nasruddin is here. I'll ride up next to you. And so he sat next to the coachman and they got there. And on the way, on the way that there was some sort of bumpy road or something, and the coachman was worried if Nasruddin was okay. And so Nasruddin called back, went down, opened the door, and said, are you okay in there? And shut the door and came back and said, yes, Nasruddin is fine. And they went on and they arrived at the banquet, and all these fine carriages and people were arriving. And Nasruddin said, I think we should wait a bit until people have gone in. Nasruddin does not want to be seen by a lot of people. And also, when he goes in, you have to avert your eyes again. He does not want to be seen by you. And so the coachman said, oh, yes, of course, no problem, and covered his head with his cloak and turned away. And Nasruddin got down and opened the carriage door and closed it. And then climbed back up and said, okay, Nasruddin he's gone. And the coachman said, well, I think we should wait here until the end of the banquet to pick him up. And Nasruddin said, oh no, let's go up on the hill there by the river and watch the stars and have a nice evening. And we can see the banquet down below. And when people start coming out, then we know it's over and we can come back down. So they do that and they spend wonderful time, and Nasruddin asks the man all about him, is interested in his story and his family, the coachman, and talk about the stars and astronomy and the river and amazing evening. And then the banquet is finished and they see these people coming out, and the coachman said, oh, we have to go now, we have to get Nasruddin. And Nasruddin said, oh no, let's wait till the crowd thins out. Nasruddin won't come out when there's a lot of people there. Oh, okay. So they wait, and then they go, and they get there. And Nasruddin opens the door, does the same thing. He makes him cover up his head and whatever. And then they go, and they come home. They get home to the Nasruddin's house, and Nasruddin gets down and tells him to look away, and opens the door and lets him in the house. Everybody comes back and said, you know, the. I hope that Nasruddin had a good time. I hope that my service was great for him. And Nasruddin said it was absolutely wonderful. I know for a fact that Nasruddin appreciated the time that you took. And the coachman said, oh, and I appreciate so much the evening I spent with you. I can't imagine a better evening spent, you know, looking at the stars, talking about the river. You've been such a wonderful, you know, partner for this evening, and may Nasruddin be blessed to have you as his servant. And Nasruddin said, oh, I know for a fact that he is, and that he appreciates you, and may, you know, Allah protect you and whatever. And the coachman drives off. So what is the moral of that story, right? Nasruddin gets out of the, doesn't have to go to the banquet. really spends time with this guy, sees him, talks with him. No one probably ever talks to him like that. Is not attached to his identity of being Nasreddin, right? He doesn't, all of this praise and all of this, these people wanting to honor Nasreddin, and he's just this simple guy who rides with the coachman and doesn't need any special treatment, and doesn't even need any special recognition for having spent this moment and really, really been with somebody for that time, you know. And the guy gives thanks for it. And Nasreddin gives thanks for it as well, because he appreciated the service that the guy did, that he looked away, that he respected, you know, the advice, and that he sat with him by the river and talked about the stars and astronomy and the river, whatever. Now, if you know, maybe the coachman, all of his ideas about Nasreddin were not necessarily, he didn't necessarily let go of them. But in a sense, he did, because he said, oh, okay, he doesn't want to be seen. I won't look at him. I'll let go of it. You know, he opened to that instead of, oh, no, but I want to see Nasreddin. He let go. And then he was, or he let go of his idea of we have to sit in front and wait for the dinner to finish. He let go of it. And then he was able to open to the stars and the astronomy and the river and the night with the guy riding next to him. And he had no idea he was with Nasreddin all this time. And Nasreddin didn't have to tell him that. He had nothing to offer but just this moment. And both of them, that's all they offered, was just that moment together. And that was probably a greater feast than what would have transpired at the prince's banquet. Sometimes I've wondered about that story, though, if the coachman didn't get in trouble from the whoever sent him because Nasreddin didn't show up at the banquet. I don't know. We don't get the rest of that story, but so there could be a downside to it. But our whole practice is just about, you know, maintaining equanimity in the midst of unknowing, of just appreciating whatever it is. Doesn't mean liking whatever it is, you know. All of these dishes served at the Thanksgiving table. And people become very attached to their family traditions. And so, if you don't have, and depending where you live in America, there's different foods that are served. I knew someone here in Paris who was American from the South. And if you didn't serve, what was it, creamed pearl onions or something like that, that was not really Thanksgiving. Or if you, you know, if the stuffing in the turkey was not chestnuts, it wasn't really Thanksgiving. But could we just let go of those attachments to that specific item and appreciate the items that are there? Like tonight, we could say, oh, so and somebody is not here. Well, can we appreciate who is here? Also appreciate who is not here, but recognize that if we're focusing on who is not here, then we're not paying attention to who is here and who is sharing this moment with us. I think it was last week, it was Joa who was talking about when Dogen came back from China, having received the Dharma transmission in China and then brought that practice back to Japan. And someone asked him, what teaching have you brought, or what have you gained while you were in China? And he said, nothing. I've gained nothing. And that That too we can say about our Zen practice. We don't gain anything, but we let go of many things, which in fact is a huge gain. Maybe what we gain is letting go of everything. And it's another one of those Zen paradoxes, but it's true. And the more that we let go, then the more we can be thankful and appreciate. I have a tooth problem at the moment, and I'm so thankful for when I don't have a tooth problem. Or Bernie Glassman used to say, we don't even think of the fact that we have a stomach until our stomach hurts. We don't appreciate our stomach until it hurts. So can we appreciate before the tooth hurts? Can I appreciate my teeth and all this work they do and all the service that these teeth offer me and have provided throughout all of these years? And most of us take care of our teeth because we want them to keep providing the service. We don't want to have a toothache, so we keep taking care of them. But do we really appreciate them? And do we really appreciate the don't know. Any think of anyone in your life, look at if we do sometimes do metta meditation, loving kindness, and we, try to offer this loving kindness and this wish for happiness and wellness and all of this to various people. Can we, look around and think of, okay, what am I grateful for? Sometimes we do this at Thanksgiving, we ask people, well, what are you grateful for? But I don't, we can do this every moment if we don't attach, if we don't become fixed on the replica of someone else's mind, as Noam Chomsky, said. I mean, he was encouraging people to open their minds and not, and open to critical thought, to creative thinking. But it's the same thing as what we are inviting people to do by entering not knowing. It's letting go of the usual way of thinking, being, attaching. And then we can be grateful for this feast that is our life, this supreme meal that is our life, as Bernie would say. Even when there's a toothache, or even when the world is in chaos, we can always be grateful for just this moment, for these people, for this breath. This life. So maybe I will stop. That's my little Thanksgiving chat. And here, if you want to share anything, comment. Lisa?
Actually, this year, my mother did Thanksgiving 2 weeks early and without me. And she went, she doesn't like turkey, so she got a goose and went all the way to Normandy, where she has a little house, to get the goose because she couldn't find one in Paris. It was too early. So that's how attached she is to Thanksgiving, but at the same time, not completely attached because it's a goose and not a turkey, and It's quite an untraditional way of doing it, I guess. But anyways, it's a tradition in itself. So that's Thanksgiving. That's Thanksgiving for me, and yeah, it's yeah. Anyway, so thank you for sharing these Nasreddin stories. They're pretty wonderful, and it reminds me of a story which my father used to tell, and I'm a very bad teller, storyteller, and I don't remember it well, but the gist is there's this old man fishing with his old fishing rod, and someone comes and he's getting a lot of fish, and someone comes along and tells him, a friend or something, well, you know, you could get a fishing boat and then you'd get a lot of fish, and then you could hire people and get a lot of money, and then you could have your own fishing boat and then just spend your day fishing. And he says, but I already have all that. Why would I do get the huge fishing anyway? So it's just, yeah, enjoy what you have. Simple, doesn't need to be anything special. So thank you for this. Is it a storybook, or where do you get these stories from?
There are collections of them. I've heard them like from, well, Genpo used to tell the one about the donkeys, where he was trafficking donkeys.
Oh yeah, I remember. Yeah.
And I think the banquet ones, I don't know, maybe Bernie, I heard those or so. Or so, there's books though of them, of his stories. There's, you know, hundreds of stories of Nasreddin, and maybe even more in the Arab world. You know, maybe the ones that have filtered to us are maybe less. And for children, there's even some Nasreddin stories.
Yeah, thank you, Rushia. Nasreddin, I haven't thought about him in a long time, but he's been in my life on and off. And it's very odd, but this year, what happened about Thanksgiving, your story sounded kind of, there was a parallel somewhere. I have been going for many years, too many years, to a place at Thanksgiving that I really was not at ease. There was something, I don't know, fakey or pushed about it. A lot of protocol. Now we eat this, and now we say thank you, and now we do this, and I really didn't want to go, and but I don't want to lie about it. How could I get out of this? And then I got invited by somebody else. So I thought, well, that got fixed. But then what about tonight? What about Thursday night? But the other people that invited me, it's not for tonight, it's for Saturday because they work tonight. So the whole thing just, all of the pieces of my problem came apart, and then everything got sort of fixed. I don't have to be at the phony party. I get to go, and the guy is a really good cook to the guy on Saturday, and I can be here with you all, where I have a true sense of Thanksgiving. So it all kind of worked out. Because I wasn't going to have a meal with people tonight, I thought, well, I had to walk to diverse places. I do this thing sometime when I think of it, but I thought of it today to say thank you for everything that still works. Because I know this tooth business. I've had years of toothache, and you remember for about 3 or 4 days after it's over to be really pleased and grateful that your mouth works again. And then it sort of fades. You forget all about it. So I did my own. Thank you for all the things that do work. I can still walk around and my feet feel good on the ground and all that sort of thing. And actually, saying that, maybe I should do it more often because it made it very pleasant to go and get the bus.
Nice, yeah. Yeah. Changes our existence, huh? When we are grateful and recognize and appreciating and yeah.
Good evening, everyone. When you were mentioning this is just a repetition, actually. this way of looking at the language, you know, which is something so important. So the how the English that is spoken at that time is so much more. It's close. It's of course it's English is closer to this connection, and also the French in Quebec is actually, which is looked down upon by nowadays modern French speakers from France. Actually, the same thing happens with the Portuguese, actually. So the Brazilian Portuguese spoken in Brazil by Brazilians, it's much closer than the Portuguese spoken in Portugal by Portuguese people in Portugal. The Brazilian Portuguese is much closer to the time when the language arrived there, actually, and it's much more closer to the medieval Portuguese even. This is always a good argument when you are talking with someone who is, you know, maybe a person can be more right wing in some way, you know, like this defending this idea, you know, and how the language is being changed or something, and people are not speaking properly because of the influence of the Brazilian Portuguese. Well, you know, it's actually Brazilian Portuguese is closer to this historical, traditional, if you want, language. So it's always interesting to I guess that will happen with a lot of languages that went somewhere else. About the second story of Nasreddin that you told, and the coachman, you know, I was also thinking that if he knew that he was with Nasreddin, probably he would have appreciated it as well. But he wouldn't be, what came to me was he wouldn't be appreciating exactly the same thing, or that could happen. He would have been appreciating that this idea that he was with Nasreddin. What he did appreciate in the way the things happened, he appreciated the person and the actual situation he was with. Like he was closer to what was, and not to an idea. What also came about this was a Portuguese novel from the 19th century, probably the most famous one. It was published in 1888. Actually, the same year that Fernando Pessoa was born, this was published in that year. So it's a big novel. It's set in the Portuguese society of the time, so very male-oriented society. And there is a situation of, actually, it turns out it's an incest, but at the time we're not aware of that. So this guy, he's the main character in the book. He starts an affair with a married woman. She's a married woman, and there's at some point it's very interesting because, you know, when things start to develop, and you know, they've known each other for a while now at that point, and you know, and she's upset with him, and this is what she asks him. Well, who do you love? Of course, this is the language, of course, about loving people. Who do you love? You know, do you love me? Is it me, or are you loving the other guy's wife? You know, so this label, you know. Are you, in a way, she's asking, are you appreciating me for who I truly am? Or are you appreciating only this aspect of myself, which is being married to this other guy? And this is really this, and basically you are just enjoying this aspect of, I don't know, adventure, secrecy or something. Or are you appreciating me for who I really am? Or just the label, basically. So that's also came up, and because of the Nasreddin story with the coachman. Thank you.
What's the novel?
Oh, Os Maias. Yeah, it's a name. It's a family name. It's a family name. Maya, it's the surname, last name of the family. So yeah, I will get you a copy. I've been meaning to do that for a while. Get you a copy and a translation. Yes, it's a big book, but it
Must
might.
exist in English, though, right?
Oh yeah. In French, I'm sure there is as well.
Intention.
Yes.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't want to hog the floor. I'll be quick, but I was reminded when you were talking about the English people during COVID, and I haven't gone back to see if I can find it again. I found a thing, a documentary in some Philadelphia, I think. They've reconstituted a colonial bakery and the butcher and everything, and the people in the places speak the English of the time. I love American history and I love the history of the language. And it was just flabbergasting. I mean, you can understand it. I don't know how they put it together. You can understand it, but it's not anything like anything that we've ever spoken. It was just overwhelming. I don't, as I said, I have no idea how they came up with it, but maybe somebody really studied the problem. It's on YouTube somewhere.
Okay. And it's because you were like going down the deep rabbit hole through YouTube that you found it during COVID? I mean, like looking for material to watch or something?
Well, as I say, I love history. So I went and looked at the history of New Orleans, the history of Philadelphia, and this must have come up. Bill Bryson wrote a book about the evolution of the English language, and which is not only about that, but I'd already thought about that a lot. Would we be able to understand them? And then there they were in this pretend colonial village speaking colonial English. It was so wonderful.
Yeah. All these ideas we have, huh? And yeah. Even, that we have this word in America, Yankee, for the people who are from the North. The United States and the it's a derogatory in the South, it's a derogatory term. They call the Northerners Yankees. And I had heard various versions of where that came from. One was that the French at the time sounded like the way that the English speakers heard the French referring to them. When they heard them say les Anglais, they thought it was Yankee, sounded like that. But actually, that's not it. It was the Dutch who colonized Manhattan, New York, actually, and also other areas in that part of the country. A very common name at the time was Yanke. And the English speaking colonists just started calling everybody who was Dutch Janke. And, kind of like you would just call every French person Pierre or every, American Johnny or something. So they were all just Janke. And then it became this thing where the Dutch then started calling the English. They heard them saying Yanka, and then anyone who used that term Yanka became a Yankee. It became pronounced Yankee. Yanka, Yankee. I told this to my Dharma brother, Michel Oltaten, who is Dutch, and he said, "Well, of course, we know that. The Dutch know this." Americans have no clue, but the Dutch know it. So you see, again, we have all these ideas, and when we open to just, oh, okay, not having a replica of someone else's mind or some other idea. Oh, okay, that's interesting. And then appreciating those people who were called Yanka and the people who were calling them Yanka, Yankee. And then the evolution of it. Marek, you for a while.
Yes, and first of all, let me express my appreciation for being able to see all of you again. And on today's occasion, very happy Thanksgiving to those of you who have some American roots, whether you are celebrating or not. Sorry to hear about your tooth problem, Roshi. I hope it will go away very soon. About the character that you in those two stories of Nasreddin, when you told those stories, it reminded me very much about two poems from Far East, from IQ and Ryokan. The I think they were both Japanese. They were both Zen people and poets as well, but they were quite modest. They didn't like the position. I think IQ was appointed an abbot, and he lasted, I think, 9 days or so before he quit. And I guess Ryokan never really wanted to be in charge of any organization. They just wrote the poetry. They also, like Ryokan liked to play with children from the village, and it was his joy. And I remember that I mentioned the Ryokan about 2 weeks ago when I was here previously, and I told you about this character, this poet, and one of you expressed wish or disappointment that I didn't not presented any poem by him. So I came prepared today, and if you like, I would be happy to share this poem with you. And also, it figuratively says something about my feelings toward this very nice group and my not being here very often. So this poem is called "Reply to a Friend's Letter." Your smoky village is not far from here, but icy rain kept me captive all morning. Just yesterday, it seems, we passed an evening together discussing poetry. But it's really been 20 windblown days. I have begun to copy the text you lent me, fretting how weak I've become. This letter seals my promise to take my staff and make my way through the steep cliffs as soon as the sun melts the ice along the mossy path. So that's on the theme of, my feelings toward this group. Of course, the feelings to see you one day, hopefully, and realization that it's been such a long time since we've seen each other again for the last time, and that this is so.
Marek, beautiful.
Thank
So this was Ryotan or
you.
Ryokan or
Ryokan, I
beautiful.
think he has ryokan something, but the ryokan certainly as a ryokan as the Japanese inn. This is the same the same name. And I found two collection of very fine poems, some haiku, some in a different style. But I just didn't know about this character because he's not so well. But according to the translator, they are both Ikkyu and Ryokan. They are both loved in by the public and there. So maybe there it says also something about about our appreciation for those characters that are modest and not seeking attention, that they are.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Beautiful. We are about out of time here. Thank you, everyone, for sharing and listening and being present and joining us to share in this moment. Thank you.